We're going to start the book of Esther. I know Esther doesn't follow Ezra. That's because Nehemiah follows Ezra. And since the ladies have been going through Nehemiah and the men have been going through Nehemiah, I thought, well, I better not be stupid enough to go through and add a third group going through Nehemiah. So I figured we've been through it enough, and I hope that's okay with you. So we're going to skip to the book of Esther. And the book of Esther takes place during the days when Persia ruled the world. And that is from 539 to 331 BC. That's when Persia was king of the hill. The events in this book will cover a period of 10 years, from 483 to 473 BC, I believe. The book of Esther gives us the historical background to what we know as the book of the Feast of Purim. It's a Jewish festival, Jewish feast. It's still celebrated by the Jews today. It looks something like Halloween. Oh, Daniel, could you put the antenna up? That's why I'm having a hard time getting these things to work. It looks something like Halloween, because the kids all dress up for Purim. The girls all dress up to be like Esther, and the boys sometimes dress to be like Mordecai, sometimes like Haman, the evil, wicked guy. The time of year, it's March, February, somewhere in there. This year, Purim fell on February 24th and 25th. Next year, it falls on March 16th and 17th. So that's the time of year that it falls on. And more than just a background to Purim, though, the book of Esther is a testimony of how God watches over his people, how God watches over and protects Israel. We've seen in the book of Daniel, especially about these angelic forces that are at war behind the scenes. Remember back in Daniel chapter 10, about how this angel that comes to Daniel has been fighting with the prince of Persia, and how the prince of Greece is coming, and all of this. How God is out to protect his people, Israel. In this book, in Esther, we're going to see one of the plots to wipe out Israel. Anti-Semitism is nothing new. It's been around since forever. And it raises its ugly head like no other time in the book of Esther. Some have suggested that the book of Esther shouldn't be part of the Bible because the name or the word God is not used. The name of God is not found. You will not see Elohim, Yahweh. You won't see any of that in the book of Esther. There's hints that God's there. And in fact, you can make a point that all you see is his fingerprints. You might not see him, but he's behind the scenes through this whole book. Sometimes we have the mistaken idea of how God works. There are folks I run into every once in a while who feel that unless you are reading the King James Bible and telling everybody around you that they're going to hell, and unless you obey every single bit of the Old Testament, the law and the prophets, that you are in danger of hellfire, and that if you don't do all of those things, then you can't be used of God. That's the way some people operate. Well, you're going to see in the book of Esther, God doesn't follow those kinds of rules. And in fact, the way God's going to work is very behind the scene. And in fact, I'm going to make it look very ugly tonight on purpose. Tonight is all about setting the stage for the main story, the main event. We won't get into the main event until next week. It'll start to raise its head about the main event in the book of Esther. This evening is just about setting the stage, and I'm going to make it look pretty ugly. You're going to be thinking, I was at church tonight? This was church? This is more like an R-rated movie. Now, don't worry. I'm not going to make it completely R-rated. Now, some of you are very troubled. But God doesn't always work the way you and I think he does. And that doesn't mean that he's not at work because you live in an ugly world. Oh, no. God may be very much at work. These beginning chapters give the background to the main story. And this first chapter in particular is going to take place years before the actual crisis occurs. And in fact, if you just stop after where we're looking at tonight, we're just going to cover the first two chapters. You might think, wow, what a story. A beautiful Jewish girl becomes part of a Persian king's harem. I mean, that doesn't sound very good. How could she be the hero of the book? I got news for you. She's the hero of the book. God is going to use all kinds of things in our lives. I'd like to suggest to you that I don't think anything is wasted in our lives. I was so tickled when I got David's list of songs that he was doing for tonight. Because one of the songs that's been on my heart lately, and we've been practicing at the band, you'll be doing that Sovereign song. We'll be doing that in a few weeks on Sunday mornings. Dave's been at work with that in the band. But the idea that God is at work in everything in our lives, you betcha he is. You betcha. Even in the things that aren't fun, the things that are hurtful, the things that are sinful, God's at work in it. God can work all things together towards the good, for the good, for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And I hope that you'll begin to catch a glimpse of that tonight as we get into the book of Esther. So, chapter 1, verse 1. My title for this first 9 verse, Persia Parties. Sorry, that's what it's about. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Egypt. In those days when Ahasuerus sat on the throne, we'll stop there here a second. Let's talk a little bit about the days of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, let's see if I can pronounce the name right. Ahasuerus. I think that's how we would say it in Hebrew. Ahasuerus. His name means I will be silent and poor. That's one of his names, Persian names. He lived from 519 to 465 BC. He is usually known in history as Xerxes. Xerxes the First. It's the same person. He ruled from 486 to 465. I got that wrong up there. Typo. Xerxes is not a believer in Yahweh. He is not a God follower. He is as pagan as they get. And from time to time, movies come out about Queen Esther, and I'm kind of toying with the idea. I went out and ordered the last one that was made a couple years back, and I want to see, I don't know, maybe we'll show it. I don't know when we get done with the book. I don't know. I'll think about it. And I don't even know how they deal with Ahasuerus. But some of the movie treatments make him seem like just such a nice sweetie pie guy. He is a pagan. He is as pagan as they get. As best as history can determine, he's a follower of the philosopher Zoroaster. What's the guy's name? Anyway, Zoroastrian. This is not a Christian religion. There are still some estimates 160,000 people in the world that still follow this Zoroastrian way. This is an ancient religion that goes back into what we think of as Iran nowadays, but the ancient Persians. They do believe in one God. They believe in a resurrection, but there's very little else that parallels the worship of Yahweh and Christianity. Be careful about getting too romantic an idea about Ahasuerus. And I will, if you have a romantic idea about Ahasuerus, you're going to be very disappointed tonight because I'm going to rip that off. I'm going to rip that scab right off. This is a pagan man. In the movies, he'll look like this. We'll see a clip. In ancient Persian reliefs, that's the way they portray him. Some make him look like this. And it says he ruled from India to Ethiopia. The India that they're talking about is our current Pakistan. So he rules from here all the way over. His kingdom that was handed to him was all of this. He will conquer this during this chapter. He will cross into Greece. Verse 2, and in those days, King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan.
Shushan was also known as Citadel. Susa. Prior to Daniel's day, Susa had been known as the capital of the Elamites.
This is back from Daniel chapter 8.
They had
8.
Ruled the area for over 1,000 years before Daniel came along. In Daniel's day, Susa had become part of the Babylonian Empire. In 10 years, which would be 540 BC, Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus, would flee from Susa as Cyrus the Great began to conquer bits and pieces of the Babylonian Empire. After the Persians conquered Susa, Darius the Great would build a great palace there, and it was in that palace the next king, Xerxes, also known as Ahasuerus, would host the great feast in the Book of Esther. It was in this palace that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the next Persian king, Artaxerxes.
Now, I don't know if you remember that from Daniel chapter 8. It was critical in the days of Daniel. It would eventually be conquered by the Persians and become their capital. Xerxes' dad, Darius the Great, was the one who would build up Susa and make it the chief capital of Persia. At times, there were up to four different capitals in Persia, but by this day, it is the chief capital. And you can still see, as you saw, you could see the outlines of this citadel, this fortress that would be where our party is going to take place. Verse 3, that's in modern Iran. That in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. Third year of his reign lands at 483 BC. Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, he's 36 years old at this time. And he throws this big, well, he's calling it a party or a feast where he shows the riches of his glorious kingdom. When you match this story against secular history, you find out some fascinating things. Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, is working on a battle with Greece. 10 years earlier, in 490 BC, his father, Darius the Great, suffered a great defeat at the hands of the Greeks. That was the first time in history that anybody up to that point had defeated the Persians. It was a great battle at a city called Marathon, and that's a whole other thing. And if that sounds like, the word Marathon sounds familiar to you, that's because it comes from this battle. That's another story. But Ahasuerus now, 10 years later, he wants revenge. And he is planning a battle in Greece. He's planning to cross over from Asia into Europe, where the current city of Istanbul. Anybody been to Istanbul in this room? Come on, there you go. Some people spent their honeymoon there in Istanbul. He's about ready to make that cross to bring his army of supposedly 2 million Persians and to face Greece. And it has been suggested that during this party, this feast that lasts 180 days, there's something behind it. He's got his nobles, his military leaders together, and they're planning the attack. They're building up forces at that peninsula that crosses from Turkey into Greece. They're planning how they're going to do this. And the battle will take place in 480 BC. We're now 3 years prior to that, when this feast takes place. Verse 5, and when those days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, for great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So after the six-month brouhaha, he has another 7-day party, has a big drinking party. He breaks out the booze for 7 days, verse 6. So there's two separate feasts here. Verse 6, there were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple with silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pattern of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. This is quite a detailed description. This isn't a make-believe story. This is somebody that has knowledge of what went on. And perhaps we have a picture here of the actual event. They're dressed in tuxes, and No, I'm sorry. Okay. But it's something like this. It's a grand thing with, you know, all kinds of curtains and marble pillars and all this kind of stuff. Verse 7, and they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. In other words, nobody was required to drink, nobody was forced to drink, but nobody was forced to stop drinking. Josephus records, he also gave orders to the servants that they should not force them to drink by bringing them wine continually, as is the practice of the Persians, but to permit every one of the guests to enjoy himself according to his own inclination. So he's a very gracious host. Verse 9, Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. This is Xerxes' wife, Ahasuerus' wife. Her name means beautiful. And so while he's hosting this party, probably with the men, the women are off having their own party that Vashti is hosting. We do know now that it was a Tupperware party. No, verse 10, sorry. Are you awake? Am I keeping you interested? Are you excited about this? Okay, verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus. By the way, eunuchs usually had the job of watching the harem because they were eunuchs because they were surgically altered. Is that a nice way to say that? Surgically altered so that they wouldn't mess with the women, right? So you don't have anybody watch over the women. You have only the eunuchs watch over the women. So he commands these eunuchs, verse 11, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come to at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Now, he made this order to bring in Vashti to show her beauty. Now, some people suggest maybe he just wants to have a fashion show and have everybody admire how beautiful she is in her lovely evening gown. Very possible. Jewish scholars say that when it says that she was wearing her royal crown, that's probably all she was wearing. That's what he wants. You know, it's funny to read the commentaries because someone go, oh, no. It's, no, not naked. I think it's naked. I think that's what he's doing. That's what he's wanting. It's a drinking party. The guys are drunk. She's beautiful. He wants to show her off. Whatever it is, she doesn't want any part of it. Ladies, do you blame her? Huh? No, of course you don't. Guys are going, well, I don't know. It wasn't that bad, you know. It says they were merry with wine. This happens when the king is merry with wine. He is drunk. He is drunk. Stupid, drunken people. I was thinking I probably could have found something on YouTube about that, huh? Stupid drunk tricks or something like that. I didn't think about that till just now. Pay attention, folks. Ahasuerus' marriage is going to fall apart because of his stupid, drunken actions. Don't miss that. His marriage is going to fall apart. Watch what Proverbs says to kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Now, you may not be a king, but alcohol affects your decision making. We're dealing with a person who doesn't get this. Several of us in the church have been working with this fellow, and he doesn't get it. He doesn't understand why he's in jail right now. Well, he's in jail because he's been breaking the law. Why did he break the law? Because he's been doing stuff while he's drunk. Been drunk for 40 years. And drunkenness makes you forget that. He doesn't seem to think it's any big deal that he drives while he's drunk. Did you know that there's laws against driving while you're drunk? Did you know that? And there's a reason for that. Now, he claims he can drive better drunk than most people can while they're sober. That's how he talks himself into it being okay. Drunken people do stupid things. And what you're going to watch happen in the life of Ahasuerus over the next few verses, he's drunk. He's the king of the world, but he's drunk, and he's doing something stupid. Josephus records, watch what Josephus records. But she, talking about Vashti, out of regard to the laws of the Persians, she's concerned about the laws of the Persians, which forbid the wives to be seen by strangers. How about that? There was a law in Persia that wives aren't supposed to be seen by strangers. Now, what that exactly meant, maybe, I don't know, but she did not go to the king. And though he oftentimes sent the eunuchs to her, she did none, nevertheless stay away and refused to come. Isn't that fascinating? He's the drunk one, and he doesn't have regard to the law, his own laws, because he's drunk. Drinking makes Ahasuerus ask his wife to do something humiliating. And instead of apologizing, he gets mad at her. Watch this, verse 13. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, these are the lawyers, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him being Karshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Maris, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence, who ranked highest in the kingdom. These are his inner circle, his kitchen cabinet, his advisors. He says to these guys, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law, because she did not obey the king of a king Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? And Memucan, one of these advisors, had answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. She hasn't just hurt you, buddy. She's hurt all of us. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. Did you follow what he's saying? He's saying, well, we've got to deal with this, because if word gets out that the queen doesn't do what the king says, we're all in trouble. Our wives are going to start thinking they could do the same thing too. The ladies of Persian Media. Memucan is afraid that Vashti is setting a bad example. All the wives are going to revolt. I kind of wonder if Memucan is having a little trouble at home as well. In fact, I kind of wonder if he isn't in the doghouse.
All
right, here we go. There it is. Okay.
This is my anniversary gift?
Yep.
A vacuum cleaner?
Dual bag. This is the best vacuum cleaner you'll ever have, baby.
Get in there.
What? Not a big fan of that look. I gotcha.
New arrival in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
What is this place?
You are in the doghouse.
Dog?
Since time immemorial, when men have messed up, they get sent here by the wives or girlfriends. Fold.
Yeah, but I don't deserve to be here. I didn't do anything.
Every man in the doghouse thinks he's innocent. Isn't that right, boys?
Look, all I know is that I got my wife this really nice gift, and then now here.
What'd you get her?
This brand new dual bag vacuum cleaner, actually.
Hear that, boys? You got our vacuum cleaner.
You're a fool, man.
Oh, it was dual bag.
And dual bag doesn't know why he's here.
I realize it's not the most romantic gift, but
there are many reasons a man can end up in here.
Hey, dual bag. All I did was tell my wife that her mom looked hot in a bathing suit. It was a compliment. I was just trying to be nice.
That's bull.
She was smoking. Apologize without caveat. She was smoking.
I told my wife that staying home with the kids was a heck of a lot easier than having to actually work for a living.
Pops. See, a lot of guys end up in here during the holidays because they give their wives thoughtless gifts, like a vacuum cleaner.
I got my wife extra RAM memory for her computer as a gift. I even attached a note that said, "Thank you for the memories." Didn't go down very well.
Help with the cooking. That's Oscar. He's been here so long, he's plain lost his mind. Legend has it he gave his wife a mustache waxer during the holidays.
What is that on your lip?
How do you get out?
It's real hard. I just got reviewed last week. I went up before this review board.
Let's review your offense.
Merry Christmas.
Seriously?
What? Thought you'd want to tighten up that jelly belly, no?
Wow! I'm married to you.
A little more of this, and a little less of... less of that.
Wow.
I think we're seeing enough. So, Donnie, do you think you're ready to rejoin your lovely wife?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Donald, I'll be candid. If I had my way, you wouldn't even go before this board.
I don't know what I was thinking when I gave my wife an abscessizer as a gift.
Stupid, stupid, stupid.
So next time you get her something truly nice, like a gym membership, perhaps.
Exactly. I mean, no. I wouldn't get it then. I wouldn't get it then. I wouldn't get it then. Please.
Stupid, I just want to get out of here.
You like that?
Apologize.
Yeah.
Did I fool you?
Yeah.
I didn't fool them. Set up. Trick question. I'm out the door.
Work on the folding, Donnie.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Is there any hope? Can you get out of here?
One man got out. Express Arnold.
Help with the cooking. Stop checking out other women.
He sent us this.
Offer to change.
Arnold's wife let him out of the doghouse. Not sure how he did it.
Hey, lunch!
What is this? Cheese pie?
It's peach. And chai lattes every night.
Express your feelings.
Now, note to husbands. Buying diamonds isn't what keeps you out of the doghouse. Just want to clear that up. Marriage is more than just buying the right gifts. But I got to tell you, with Ahasuerus, maybe if he wasn't drunk, might not have been in the doghouse in the first place. Or Memucan or whatever. Verse 19. Let's go back to our text. Verse 19. If it pleases the king, this is what his advisors tell him, let a royal decree go out from him and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princes. And the king did according to the word of Memucan. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. The advice, the reply, pleased the king. It's kind of important to think about where you're getting your marriage advice from. You need to think about where you get advice about your marriage from. Are you getting it from ungodly people, ungodly sources? Ahasuerus is having trouble with his wife. Can't get her to do what he wants her to do. And so he goes to his counselors and he says, "What shall we do to Queen Vashti?" And they give him advice based on what seems good in their days, that they ought to be tough on her and show her who's boss. But if you've noticed, their counsel is really based on what they're wanting in their own marriage. They're wanting him to fix their marriage. They don't want Vashti to give their own wives a reason to say no to their husbands. Sometimes the advice you get from other people is screwed up because they don't know what's up and down in the first place themselves. And they've got their own issues, their own motives. Some people want you to give up on your marriage so they can give up on theirs. And they can say to their wife, "Well, hit the door. You know, I mean, don't let the door hit you on the way out. Because look, that's what he did." You got to be careful where you're getting advice for your marriage. We make the mistake sometimes of asking the wrong people. Sometimes it's not by mistake. Sometimes we know very well why we're asking certain people, because we want them to tell us what we think they're going to tell us, because we don't want to hear the truth. We don't want to hear the right things. David wrote, he said, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by rivers of water that bring forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither. And whatever he does, he shall prosper." You have a choice of who you're going to pay attention to. You're going to pay attention to ungodly people and then go their route, or you're going to pay attention to what God says. We want to be taking advice from God. There are principles all through the scripture about what makes a good marriage. And some of it, you don't have to even go past the first couple chapters of the Bible. Jesus referred to Adam and Eve when he was asked about marriage and divorce. In Matthew 19, the Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" He answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female?" Who was made at the beginning? Adam and Eve. That God made them at the beginning. And he said, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." He's quoting from Genesis chapter 2. "So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." Jesus starts off by talking about divorce in this way. Look, that's not the way God planned the whole thing. God didn't initially say, "Well, you got three tries at marriage." God said, two people become one. That was God's original plan. God's original plan was you get married, you stay married, and it's just two have become one. And what God has joined together, don't anybody tear apart. Now they'll say, "Well, then how come Moses said all you have to do is write a bill of divorcement and you're divorced?" And Jesus said, "Well, it's because of the hardness of your heart." God allows it. God understands it's going to happen. And some of you have been divorced. It's not the end of the world. But God's original intent was work it out. That's God's original plan, was work it out. You can do this. Adam and Eve were the example. That's God's counsel. There's some really cool lessons about Adam and Eve. For example, Genesis 2:25 says, They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Well, I thought this kind of interesting, thinking about this in light of Ahasuerus and Vashti. He wants her naked in front of everybody. But this says the man and his wife were both naked and unashamed, not in front of everybody, but just with each other. He's got this all wrong, this Ahasuerus. He wants just one-sided stuff. And I got to tell you, the beautiful principle in Genesis 2:25 is not about nakedness. It's about openness. It's about transparency. Is that God wants you to not have any barriers up between you and your spouse, that everything's open, and it doesn't happen overnight. It's too scary to do that overnight. But over time, that's what you work towards, so that you know each other's flaws. You know each other's weaknesses. You know all the blemishes, all the things that they hide from other people. That's okay, but they don't hide them from you. And you see it, and you accept it, and you love them anyway. That's God's plan for marriage, is that it's complete openness, and I'm still loved. Isn't it amazing that Deborah Lynn McKay has stayed married to me for 35 years? I just find that amazing. I am just totally amazing. Nobody knows me like she does. And she stuck it out with me for 35 years. That's absolutely amazing. Marriage is openness to each other and being loved just the way you are. That's God's plan for marriage. Be careful about where you're learning marriage from. Some of us have great examples in our parents, some of us not so much. Make sure you learn from the right examples of what God wants in marriage. Now, chapter 2. Let's go to chapter 2. So after these things, when the wrath of... So he kicked her out. He kicked her to the curb, by the way. He got rid of Vashti. He did what they said, and that was it. So after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. In other words, he's kind of starting to miss her a little bit. But let me just bring in history for a second. Because this next act of history, you're going to see in verse 16, it takes place 4 years later. So this isn't like 3 weeks later. This is 4 years later. And let me tell you what happened during those 4 years. In the first chapter, it took place in the third year of Ahasuerus. He was getting ready to march against Greece. His war with Greece, which the preparations would start in 483 BC, but by 480 BC, 3 years later, he was ready to march into Greece, which included the famous battle at Thermopylae when he was held off by three whole days by the Spartans. They fought for 3 days by him and his 1.5 million versus 300 Spartans. He held them off for 3 days. Xerxes and Leonidas. This takes place after that battle.
Let me guess.
Here's Leonidas.
You must be...
in the movie.
Xerxes.
If you get creeped out by Xerxes, that's acceptable. I hope you're creeped out.
Come, Leonidas. Let us reason together. It would be a regrettable waste. It would be nothing short of madness for you, brave king, and your valiant troops to perish. All because of a simple misunderstanding. There is much our cultures could share.
Haven't you noticed we've been sharing our culture with you all morning?
Yours is a fascinating tribe. Even now you are defiant. In the face of annihilation and the presence of a god, it isn't wise to stand against me, Leonidas. Imagine what horrible fate awaits my enemies when I would gladly kill any of my own men for victory.
And I would die for any one of mine.
You Greeks take pride in your logic. I suggest you imply it. Consider the beautiful land you so vigorously defend. Picture it reduced to ash at my whim. Consider the fate of your women.
Clearly, you don't know our women. I might as well have marched them up here, judging by what I've seen. You have many slaves, Xerxes. A few warriors. It won't be long before they fear my spears more than your whips.
It's not the lash they fear. It is my divine power. But I'm a generous god. I can make you rich beyond all measure. I will make a warlord of all Greece. You will carry my battle standard to the heart of Europa. Your Athenian rivals will kneel at your feet. If you will but kneel at mine.
You are generous. As you are divine, O King of Kings. Such an offer only a madman would refuse. But the idea of kneeling, it's, you see, slaughtering all those men of yours has left a nasty crack in my leg, so kneeling will be hard for me.
There will be no glory in your sacrifice. I will erase even the memory of Sparta from the histories. Every piece of Greek parchment shall be burned. Every Greek historian and every scribe shall have their eyes put out and their tongues cut for their mouths. Why, honoring the very name of Sparta or Leonidas will be punishable by death. The world will never know you existed at all.
The world will know that free men stood against a tyrant, that few stood against many. And before this battle was over, that even a god king can bleed.
Now, I don't know how accurate that is with history. This is Hollywood's version twist on it. But I think there's some foundational things that they got right. And if you think Xerxes is a little bit creepy, that's okay. That's why I'm showing this to you. I want you to be just a tad creeped out by this guy. Don't take him on as your hero. He is a very flawed person. And even though Ahasuerus would win this battle, Xerxes would win. Within a week, he would have wiped them out. But is later that year, he will be ultimately defeated by the Greeks at a naval battle at Salamis. And he will withdraw from Greece. And in light of these defeats, he returns home. And that's where this chapter picks up. He's just lost to Greece. And he comes home and he starts missing Vashti. Okay, you got it? That's the scene. This is what's happening. Verse 2, then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be brought before the king. Now, they suggest to bring in beautiful young virgins. We're going to have some tryouts for queen, something like this. And they don't want Vashti to come back because, after all, since they all turned on her, she might put them to death. So they're looking for a new wife, verse 3, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Verse 4, then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. Verse 5. In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, we meet Mordecai. He is called a Jew. The word is Yehudi. This is the very first time you see the word Jew in the Old Testament. It's from the name of the tribe of Judah. That's where the word Jew comes from, by the way. Even though we think of all Israel as being Jews, it technically comes from the word for the tribe of Judah. And his name Mordecai means little man. He's just a little man. We're told that he is the son of Shimei. I believe that this Mordecai is a descendant of Shimei, who is of the line of King Saul, who would interface with King David. 2 Samuel 16 says, this is when David is fleeing Absalom. 2 Samuel 16. Now, when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. He came out cursing continuously as he came. He's from the house of Saul. Name is Shimei. And he threw stones at David and all the servants of the and all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. Also, Shimei was thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. Now, Shimei is a messy guy. He's going to cause trouble to David. And when David comes back, finally being victorious over Absalom, he's told he should put Shimei to death. And David says, no, let's hold off. You know, let's not put anybody dead to death today because, look, I'm king again. Let's just let this thing go. Eventually, Solomon will have him, his son Solomon will have him put to death because of the difficulty he caused his father. But he is of the house of Saul. Do you recall the name of Saul's father? Kish. It all fits. And if this is the same Shimei that Mordecai is a descendant of, it's actually a very cool picture of restoration, my friends. That even though Shimei screwed up and blew it, you know what? There's going to be somebody of his descendants who will do good. Mordecai is one of the good guys. He's one of the good guys. I thought it was kind of cool to think about the fact that we're going to see another connection as the story develops, because King Saul, if this is the same guy, if this is the same lineage, King Saul failed when it came to dealing with a man named Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Agag, we believe, is the ancient descendant of a man we're going to meet next week named Haman, who's the villain of the story. And Mordecai will clash against Haman, just as Saul clashed against Agag. Saul failed, Mordecai won't. So it's kind of a cool story, very cool story. Just keep that in mind. Verse 6, it says Kish, New King James says, Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. We're getting a story of how Mordecai ends up in the Babylonian Persian kingdom. Kish had been carried away. It's the family of Kish had been hauled off to Babylon in the second captivity, which takes place in 597 BC with King Jeconiah. That's the same captivity that Ezekiel and 10,000 captives had been hauled off. If you remember all of our Daniel stuff. Verse 7. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. She was an orphan. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So Mordecai raises this gal, Hadassah. Her name, Hadassah, this is the Hebrew name. Her name means myrtle. Esther is her Persian name, which means star. And she is his uncle's daughter. That makes her his cousin. And he raises her as his daughter. So biologically, she's their cousins, but he raises her as her own, as his own, as his daughter. Verse 8. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, when many young women were gathered at Shushan, remember they're going to gather all these virgins, were gathered at Shushan, the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the woman. Now, it doesn't seem to me that Mordecai has any choice in this. It says she was taken. It's not like she applied and applied to audition for the Persian Idol show. No, it says she was taken. Was it wrong for Mordecai to allow her to be taken? I'm not sure you can even go down that road, gang. Some people will. Some people will accuse Mordecai of being a bad dad or whatever. I don't know that this is even the case. I'm not sure that he even has a choice in it. It just happens. Sometimes, as believers, we are quick to condemn people who are in ugly situations. And you know what? Sometimes you don't really have a choice about being in an ugly situation. Sometimes you don't have a choice about it. It just happens. And it's going to turn out. And I'm going to make it look really ugly tonight. On purpose. Because that's the way it is. You can't pretty this up. You can't pretty it up like they enter her into a beauty pageant. No. This is auditions for the harem. I don't know that she has a choice, but it will be used to deliver her nation. Her nation will get saved because of this messy situation. Verse 9. Now the young woman pleased him, pleased this king of the head of the eunuchs, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place, to the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. So in other words, he's already told her a long time ago, don't you tell people that you're Jewish. Just keep that to yourself. It could be that he wants to protect her from the racism that you're going to find out that he's already very well acquainted with. And keep in mind, though, that in this, it's not like Mordecai believes in secret service Christians, that you just keep it to yourself. Don't let anybody know that you're a Christian, because you're going to find out that Mordecai is very open about his faith. And he's protecting her, but he's very open to his own faith, about his own faith. But he also makes sure that people don't get their connection because of what's happening to him. Verse 11. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. So he's keeping an eye on Esther. He may not be allowed in to see her, but he does his best to keep track of her. Verse 12. Each woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying the women. We think that this oil of myrrh process that lasts for 6 months is maybe the idea of leaching or drawing out all the impurities in the gal's skins, and 6 months with the perfumes is then you spend 6 months soaking in perfume. So, man, they just smell wonderful. You know, it's just a beautiful thing. The ultra spa for a whole year. How about that? Verse 13. Thus prepared, each woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went in, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So they would go in the evening, and she would come out in the morning. So what do you think they're doing all night? Do you think they're playing checkers? Dean's nodding, yeah. You think they're playing cribbage? I don't think so. I think it's what you're thinking it is. This is a harem, for Pete's sake. These are tryouts. This is his harem. They go in as virgins, and they come out as concubines. A concubine's not a full wife, but she is also reserved for this man, which you could call her husband, but she's not his wife. It's a very messed up world these people live in. There seems to be some sense of a contract between the king and the women. They're not full wives, they're just concubines. This is the harem. This is a Persian harem. You know, from what I remember watching movies, you know, as a kid, you know, about the harems and the belly dancers, you know, and but those were tame, you know, from what's really going on. This is what's happening. Ahasuerus is a cad. He's a pagan man. This is not something to practice. Okay, have I made that point clear? Okay, verse 15. Now, when the term came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. It says she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, advised. She lets Haggai give her advice, and she takes it. She listens to advice. Haggai seems to know what works. She pays attention. She probably doesn't know what works. Proverbs 12:15, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise. It's not a bad thing, gang, to pay attention to advice. When you think you have it all figured out and you know exactly what you're doing and you don't need advice, Proverbs 12 says you're a fool. A fool doesn't want advice. Wisdom pays attention to advice. Verse 16. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So this Babylonian, that's the name of a Babylonian calendar month, is December, January is when this happens. In the 7th year of his reign, it's been 4 years since he divorced Vashti. The war has gone on. He's come home. It's been 1 year since his defeat at Salamis. This is the year 479 BC. So that kind of all fits, doesn't it? You know, he comes home after his defeat in 480 BC. The year of the processing of these women and all has taken place. And it's now the 7th year of his reign. Verse 17. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, I got to tell you, there are three very cool words used here. He loved her. The Hebrew word is ahav. It can be human love. It can be family love. It can be sexual love. She obtained grace. The word is chen. It means grace. It means favor, grace, charm, acceptance. Hanan, to give grace. Yohanan is Yahweh is gracious. And Yohanan turns into English as John or Johan. God is gracious. But that's the word that's at the root here. She obtained favor, chesed. You will see this sometimes translated loving kindness. His loving kindness is better than life. That's what God's love for us is. It means goodness, kindness, faithfulness. These are all good things. And he's got all this towards her. There's something good happening here. And he makes her queen. She's no longer she's not going to be a concubine. She becomes queen. So does this mean that Ahasuerus has turned a chapter in his life and he's gotten rid of his harem? No, not at all. He still has a harem. And you're going to see it in just about two or three verses. So keep in mind, there's some sweetness thing going happening here. She becomes queen, but he's still a jerk. Okay, so I just keep that straight of who Xerxes Ahasuerus is. He's a pagan man. Verse 18, then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. Verse 19, when virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. Virgins were gathered together a second time. He still has his harem. He's still adding to the harem. So just be careful about making this the beautiful love story of Esther and Ahasuerus. Just keep in mind the reality of this thing. Ahasuerus is not a man to emulate. This guy belongs in the doghouse again. Sorry.
Flush. Oh. Yes. Hey, fellas, I gotta get going.
Come on, man.
I gotta go apple picking with Mrs. tomorrow. I'm not kidding.
Another half hour. Come on, Dice. You want mine?
All right, a couple more hands. It's the worst that could happen, right?
You are in the doghouse.
Shut up, doolbag. I know where I am.
Hey, Donnie. You made it like, what, 5 hours on the outside?
Where's Bull?
He's in with the review boards.
Case number 478, Jonathan Bull Bulkowski.
Look, for the 100th time, all I said is that her mom looked good in a bathing suit.
And you don't see
why. It's a compliment.
And you don't understand how it's inappropriate to tell her that her mother looked hot?
I didn't say hot.
Annie?
The word he used was smoking.
Smoking?
And he made this hot sizzle noise. Like this.
Honey.
Why would you get your wife a doll for Christmas?
Saw it at a crafts fair, and it looked just like her.
Why would you think it looks like
it's
me?
It's almost like the Whittler knew her better.
What kind of gift is this?
It's a beer-making kit.
I don't even like beer.
It's a wonderful beverage.
Get out. You got your wife a paper shredder?
Sorry, a hammer drill? What?
You got her a robe?
A nice robe.
It's from a hotel.
It's a nice hotel.
Next.
5-star hotel. What else does she want?
You proposed marriage at the gym while she was on the lat machine?
I was looking in the mirror and I thought... you're quite a specimen, you know? It's time to multiply.
Just go fold.
Hey, Ellen. And Jessica.
Donnie, didn't we just see you?
That was some poker game you guys had, huh?
I know.
You're gonna be in here for a very long time, Donnie.
No, I don't think so. Look what I found.
That's nice, Helen. It's, you know.
Very smart. See you tomorrow?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Just as a review, diamonds don't get you out of the doghouse. Okay, it's not that simple. But sometimes, guys, we're so blind to what jerks we are. Pay attention. Don't be a Ahasuerus. Don't be that guy. Don't be that guy. Here he's building up his harem again. And it says, during this time, verse 19, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. We're setting up the story. Mordecai is at this point considered one of the judges. That's what happens at the city gates. The courts were held at the city gates. He's not a judge because of his relationship with Esther. Nobody knows they're connected. He's earned this on his own. Verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Now, we don't know exactly what happened, but these guys are planning to assassinate Xerxes, Ahasuerus. Verse 22. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name, and when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. And both, Bigthan and Teresh, were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, these guys were hanged on the gallows. Just a side note, this is not hanging by neck, by a rope. The Persians were the ones who invented crucifixion. This is being impaled on a stake up on high. That's what this is. And it says, all this was written in a book. One more little fact for later on, next week or two. One more thing, little notch, in important bit in the story. We're setting the stage for an amazing story of God's deliverance. I was reading over the whole book again today, and I was like, oh, I just love this story. I love all the details that God is working behind the scenes. Things that just coincidentally come together. God knows what he's doing, my friends. There really are no coincidences in God's eyes. God's name may not be in the book, but he is there. And when we are in the middle of the hardest of times, we hold on to this. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. I love the way Greg talked about this in the movie last week. It doesn't mean that God's going to make everything turn out rosy, but God works things for the good. He knows what he's doing. You're going to see this amazing story of God using the ugliest situations, the messiest of marriages, and God's going to use this to rescue the entire nation. God is sovereign. God knows what he's doing. He knows how to take care of you. He knows the mess you're in. He knows... You may not know how to get out of it, and I certainly may not know how to get out of it. God knows what he's doing. You hold on to him. You hold on to him. He works all things together for good. Let's stand and pray.